the locks. So here she is, she's Sarah Frazier, brought to you by Fox. I said, she still has the key card and they never change the locks. So here she is, she's Sarah Frazier, brought to you by Fox. Let's go.
Bob Barnard is my guest today on, this is actually called Bob, I Still Have a Key Card, is the name of this podcast.
I Still Have a Key Card?
Yes.
I do. And you do?
Yours, yes. You've had one for 18 years here at Fox.
That's right. There's no more picture on it. It's kind of faded away from being taken out of my wallet and put back in so many times. A lot of people wear them around their necks. I just stick it in my wallet and flash my wallet against the thing, and it still lets me in.
18 years. Yeah. And have you always been, what is your title? Featured reporter?
No, just reporter. I think
reporter.
The old days they called it general assignment reporter, so cover murder, mayhem, everything else.
Okay, and I have so many questions about D.C. murders.
Oh boy.
I need all of your insight. Honestly, we are... Okay, you can just think about this, because at the end, I'm going to do a lightning round, and I want to know who really killed Chandra Levy, who you believe killed her.
Okay.
So
okay.
Lots for you to think about.
Absolutely. Oh, now I'm not going to be able to think of anything else. But go ahead.
18 years. Bob Barnard, I mean, you have had an incredible career. And like you said, you've covered everything from murders to parades to, you know, public interest lifestyle things.
Absolutely.
But, of course, when you Google your name, the one thing and the very first thing that comes up is a moth laying two eggs in your ear. Is that really hard for you to take, being like a legit journalist? And then all these years, it's basically this moth that laid two sacks in your ear is what people know you for?
No. Because, you know, it's all fun and games. In a sense, you know, except when you're on the scene of a horrible thing, it's TV, it's live TV. And that was the classic unexpected thing that happened on live TV. I'm just glad I didn't kill them off. You know, it was fluttering away on my ear, loud as can be, during a live report. And we're at the Smithsonian. And it was big. It was on my chest to start.
It was like a Luna moth,
yeah,
right?
Wasn't African
it?
Moon moth.
It was African moon moth. Okay.
Probably is gone, so it was called. And the species is an African moon moth. And it was on my chest as we started the live shot. And it crawled up and started fluttering in my ear. And this thing is the size of, you know, a small pancake. And it's wailing away in my ear, and I'm kind of laughing, but we're talking about, it was Museum Week, and we were in the Butterfly Pavilion at the Smithsonian.
Natural history, right? Okay.
Yeah, what I'm thinking is, I can't swat this thing, because if I kill it, then I'll be known, you know, I was thinking, if
reporter.
I kill it, it's going to go viral. I didn't realize that it's actually laying eggs in my ear, and that's going to go viral.
Oh, my God. How did you... Okay, so it's in your ear. It's fluttering away. But then who actually noticed that it had laid two eggs?
My photographer, Indira Levine. After it left me, it crawled over and it got onto the museum director, the curator of that butterfly pavilion. It got onto him. I don't think it got on his ear. It may have. I can't remember. But when it was all done... My photographer was like, Bob, what's in your ear?
And oh, my God, Bob.
And that's where he said, oh, my gosh, those are eggs. And he said, actually, we'll clear them out. It's not like that's some kind of protected species that we have to now preserve. You have to go into hibernation for 6 weeks while these things.
That would have been awesome.
Imagine that. It's like jury duty. So they just kind of cleared it right out. But she took a photo of it. Indira, my photographer, did a still photo of the thing, and I just, for the heck of it, posted it on Twitter or something, and that did me in.
Oh, my God. It's bananas. And I just think that's so funny of your career, you know, because that's like the
exactly.
first thing. So I've been asking around, you know, researching you before we did this interview.
Oh,
and
boy.
Everybody here has so many great things and stories to tell about you, which I think is so interesting. And I had heard one that you were actually, back in the day, a page for David Letterman's show.
I certainly was.
Okay, so tell me about that. Was that like in college? Was that out of college?
That was the summer between my junior and senior years at Fordham University, which is in New York City,
that's
in the
where
Bronx.
You live.
Yeah, and I living at home, so I was a commuter to school. And I got, it's the most incredible thing that's ever happened to me besides marrying the love of my life.
Oh, good answer.
Getting this job at NBC. It was like I was working in my hometown deli on Long Island, but always wanted to be a TV reporter. Didn't know how I'd ever get started. And I'd heard about this page jobs. I guess they had this position at NBC where they have 20, 30, 40 pages at one time. And I, on a lark, went in and put in an application, was called back for an interview. Didn't think it was ever going to happen. It's very competitive, even probably more competitive now.
Oh, my God. I can imagine.
At the time, I was told there were like 2,000 applications for almost every job they had open. And when they came open, because they were coveted, and often they were filled with inside people, you know, the grandson of the chairman of NBC or RCA or whatever. And I got a call. and it, incredible. It was
okay. So tell
the kickstart of my career, really, to work at Rockefeller Center in New York wearing this blue blazer and having basically the run of the place. I could walk because I was sort of an unofficial tour guide. They didn't have the tour during the years I was there, 82, 83.
Okay.
But we just walked around the place and we had jobs to do, but the place was your oyster. And I'm this 20-year-old kid from Long Island going, oh my goodness, I'm here.
That is amazing. So who did you actually work for David Letterman?
I worked for NBC and his production company obviously did their show. It was his first year. He had started Late Night with David Letterman on NBC in February of 82 and I got my job in June of 82. So 4 months into his long run on late night TV, I was there. I was in the audience every night, getting the audience seated, keeping them quiet, getting them out. That was our job. So we worked for NBC, but the Late Night with David Letterman was the show, the five-night-a-week show that we worked around.
Did you ever have much interaction with Dave?
Very little. He'll never hear this, but he was a very odd guy.
That's what everybody says, right? Yeah. Everyone says very strange, which you can understand. You could easily see.
And I think I've heard from other people, you know, he's mellowed and gotten nicer over the years. And I'm not saying he wasn't nice, but he was not the guy you ran up and slapped on the back and said, Dave, what's going on? I mean, the aura around him was stay the hell away from me, you know? Because he came in incognito. One of our jobs was to sit in the information booth right in the main lobby at 30 Rock. So if you ever have gone through there, the main elevator bank where the stars come and go. And Dave would show up like in a ball cap and you wouldn't even realize
that it was him.
That was him. He was totally incognito. And he would come on right before the show and he'd be, oh, there he is with his shirt and tie and all that and talk to the audience and then do the show. And even after the show, he was quickly dressed back into his street clothes and he didn't welcome you to come around and chat with him. But because of my working on the show, I got to like, hey, how you doing? Whatever. Once the show started during a commercial break or whatever, and one time he was leaving his set to go into the green room, and I was the page standing there at the door, and he reached out and shook my hand and congratulated me on my promotion. He was kind of making fun of me that I'm the lowest of the low there at NBC, and I wish I had DVR'd it. You know, it doesn't. That would be a great thing to have now to say, hey, kids, look at this. You know, back when I was 20, 21, Letterman made fun of me on TV, but I didn't preserve it. But that kind of thing, just very brief little encounters here and there.
So you do the David Letterman, you know, you're a page there at NBC for a while. And then where was your first actual reporting job?
That was in Las Vegas.
Vegas. Oh my God, Bob, what did you cover? Just like gamblers and strippers? Like, what? How was
it? A lot of that. And you know what? People, it was amazing. Early on, you learn that people move to Vegas trying to like find themselves or start a new life or strike
really?
It rich. And they often bring the stuff with them that they had wherever else they lived. And they end up like hacking up their roommates and flushing the body parts down toilets and stuff. Yes.
Amazing.
You'd find a head in the desert, you know.
Oh my God.
It was a quick introduction to the crazy stuff people do to each other.
Holy crap. Okay, how long were you in Vegas?
2 years. And this was back in 84 to 86.
God,
so this was before Steve Wynn opened the Mirage. So if anybody's familiar with Las Vegas, the Mirage Hotel in like 88 opened up, and boom, after that, all these other huge hotels followed.
Yep.
When I was there, it was still the Stardust, the Sahara, the Dunes. It was kind of pre-Vegas
boom. Still that like Frank Sinatra. Okay,
exactly.
Gotcha.
And in fact, from my hometown of Long Island, New York, you'd fly from New York City to Vegas. There were no direct flights. This may sound crazy. Now you can fly 5 Southwest Airlines flights a day from BWI to Vegas. Back then in 84, I had to like either fly through Chicago or Denver or Houston. There were no direct flights.
Nothing
because
direct.
At that point, Atlantic City was still kind of happening. And Vegas was kind of this cool place, but still not what it became in the late 80s and during the 90s and
today. Oh my God.
Yeah. So it was awesome. I was working for NBC in New York and then got the job at the ABC affiliate there in Las Vegas, mainly because my boss at NBC, unbeknownst to me at the time, wrote a very nice letter to the news director, the man in charge of the news department at that ABC station, when he heard that the tape I sent, I made a fake tape. I you know, Fordham didn't have a broadcasting department. Kids today leave high school with audition tapes. College for sure. We had nothing like that. in college. So I made a fake tape while I was I ended up going from being a page at NBC to a desk assistant in the wire copy day. So I left the page office and unit and was working for the news department. And people I worked with had worked other places. And one guy had worked in Vegas and knew this guy. So I sent him a tape. And the guy called me back and said, "It looks good, but I know you have no experience." When my boss found that out, he wrote the guy. There was no email then. So he wrote the guy a letter. I ended up getting flown out there for an interview, and when that guy left about 6-8 months later, he called me into his office and said, "The only reason I gave you a job at age 22 with no experience was because your boss at NBC News, who was one of Brokaw's top buddies."
People?
Yeah, it was Brokaw's boss along the way, kind of the two of them, their careers shadowed each other.
Wow.
But this man being Brokaw's boss at many times along the way had written this letter, and he said, "Because Joe Bartlemy wrote me and said you should give this kid a shot, I hired you." And that, so again, a lucky, lucky break.
So you're there for a couple years, and then where's your next step?
In Orlando, Florida.
Orlando, Florida. And how many steps in between before you get here to D.C.?
I got hired by the CBS station in Orlando.
Okay.
And then after 5 years, I got hired by the CBS station in Tampa.
Okay.
And I had always wanted to come back north, being a New Yorker, but the station in Tampa it still is a kick-ass station.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So I was at, like, the number 3 station in Orlando.
Okay.
And the number 1 station in Tampa was calling and offered me a job. And I was like, okay, I didn't feel like staying in Florida any longer, but this was a great opportunity. So I went there, and while I was there, during the 6 years I was in Tampa, it became a Fox O&O. So it is now the Fox station in Tampa. It was the CBS station when I got there. And then it did, in 1994, when Fox TV stations became a big thing, that was one of the stations. And I was there for a total of 6 years. And then 18 years ago, I came up here to D.C. and have been here ever since.
My God. Okay, so all these years, you're covering murders and all these things. What's the art of telling a good story?
Oh, man. First of all, on TV, you got to be quick about it. You know, you can't get there let me spend a week thinking about this, or let me spend 3 hours crafting how it. No, you got to get to it. I just think whatever, at least to me personally, whatever I'm most interested in. And there's some stories you need to know. Someone was hurt or someone was killed. Here's when it happened. Here's where it happened. Here's what are they looking for someone, or did the person who do this already get arrested? You know, there's certain facts, but then to me, it's telling it as it interests me. What's the most interesting thing, and then maybe
about
filling
the
in
story
exactly, and then maybe filling in some of the details.
So, biggest story you ever broke over your career?
Oh man,
the one where you were like, "Oh my God!" Like you have that feeling you can't wait to tell it. You're one of the first people to get it out.
Man, that's a good question, Sarah. Nothing's jumping at me right now, frankly, that I broke. I mean, you build up great sources over the years, but
when they tell you something, I want to know your sources.
Oh yeah, there you go. I hate to say it. There's not one story that I'm thinking I broke that story, and kudos to me, because you know a lot of people, and sometimes you walk a fine line of, I know this person personally, and I know something that nobody else knows, but if I report that, you know, and you have an understanding with those people, sometimes
doesn't that suck? Why do you have morals, Bob?
Because you know what? When it's all said and done, I want to be able to go back and face that person. And sometimes they'll throw you stuff, but I honestly can't think of something that someone I know has thrown me that I just wowed the world breaking this story. There are little things, little bits of information or parts of a story or something, but often when you're told something, sometimes you're like, well, you know what? If I want to preserve this friendship or this acquaintance, I can't really report it, whether it eventually comes out or not, or someone else breaks it. I want to have a good, clear conscience that I'm okay with the way I left things with this person.
How much of what you hear when you're down at a murder site can you actually report? And then is a police officer coming off the record and going, yeah, we really think it's X person, but you know, you can't. How much of it is, because that would be the hardest part for me. Yeah. I have verbal diarrhea of the mouth. Like I would want to be like, but what
too.
They're really saying.
I do too, but you have to learn over time. And
but is a lot of it like, you know, just a handshake and a wink of like, well, Bob, this is kind of the real story? Like, how much of it's like, you know, a lot of dirt you don't get to report?
Yeah, you know, I guess it depends. Every story is different in that regard. I think if it's something that you if you think you report and then you're gonna have to backtrack, or you know it doesn't make sense,
okay.
or it's not necessarily important,
okay,
but you might find it interesting. That's where I kind of walk the line. I mean, you get told a lot of things, and you just kind of know over time, I can't report that, whether they tell you that or not. And I'm trying to think right now at this second of a good example of that, and I can't, but there are certain, or they'll show you things. Back in the day, they would show you something.
Really?
Like photos from a case or from a scene. Or you'd walk. I'll tell
so
you.
So what's the deal? They don't do that anymore. Is it like illegal
really,
now, or what?
Not really. And a lot of that was done in Florida because everything's open. You know, the laws on.
Well, it's also Florida.
Excuse me?
I said it's also Florida.
It is,
you know,
it's
an interesting group down there.
Totally. And you got to know, like, if you covered a certain jurisdiction exclusively, these guys would show you things, tell you things, and again, you just knew what was either cringeworthy or not. Like, if I tell people this, I mean, I can't tell them this at 5 o'clock at night. There could be kids watching, even though it's a graphic detail that nobody else knows. I'm just not, and someone else might. Another person might say, "Well, I'm going with that," but I just think of, like, if my mother heard this, if I had to explain it to someone else later on, does that matter how viciously someone was harmed? And I've seen stuff. And frankly, you used to be able to walk up to scenes. And I've seen and smelled things and been like, oh my goodness. And then having to, like, almost immediately go on air and not be showing my revulsion or my reaction. Because again, that's almost expressing
so
an opinion.
You've seen bodies, everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. How do you handle that? How have you mentally handled that?
You know what? You don't want to get hardened to it. You don't want to become a cold human. But you try to compartmentalize it. One of the first, and I've seen stuff all over the years and been told stuff. One of the worst was probably 6 months into my first job in Las Vegas. And this was, thankfully, maybe after hours. We were getting ready to leave the newsroom, and we had heard in the desert Southwest, when it rains and pours, the water coming out of the mountains become rivers. I mean, so they call them washes. And so streets will get washed out, and then they'll rebuild them. And then 3 years later, there'll be another terrible rainstorm in the desert, and it'll create another wash. And you can see the streaks in the mountains. But down in the valley, there are roads there. Well, anyway, we had heard that there may have been a bad car accident just outside of town. So we checked it out. And what happened was a big wash had come down, of like a river out of the mountains because of this rainstorm. Washed away a road. And some man in his pickup truck with his wife and three kids tried to cross it. And he failed.
Oh, my God.
The front of the pickup hit like a wall on the other side where there had been a road, which had been washed away. And the pickup truck flipped. And by the time we got there, not much long after it had happened, there was the man and the woman and the two kids laid out side by side looking like brown corpses. They were mud packed, but like an hour earlier, they were a family coming back from dinner. Right now, there they are, all four dead, and they had a helicopter up looking because there was like a 13-week-old baby that was missing that got washed away. And they eventually found it. But as a 22-year-old first-year reporter, I stood there looking, and it was at night in the desert, but lit up with all the police vehicles, and I walked right up on it. You know, I don't think that would happen as much today. Police are pretty quick to keep you back, but we got there, and seeing that family just laying there dead, I mean, here it is. What's that? That was 1984.
Right, and you remember it so vividly.
So 31, 32 years later. That kind of stuff, if you let it bother you, you'd probably pack it up and become a librarian or do something in a more peaceful, calm environment. And I've always stayed with it and tried to kind of compartmentalize seeing and hearing about things that most humans find, you know, awful.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, that's really hard to stick with.
Yeah. No, it's and that's what we do. We see things and we hear things and we report things that usually are either at the greatest of someone's, you know, time of
career,
a person's
life, or
at the worst.
So tell me this: what's like a major mistake you've made in your journalism career?
You know, they're major. Thank goodness. I honestly can't think. Nothing major pops into my mind, but little minor things drive me nuts, and they happen.
What?
Like putting the wrong name on a screen, and maybe, you know, you were told a name and you wrote it down, but somehow you had a brain fart, and when you came to write it down and put the name on the screen, you put something else, and you're like, oh, that's not right. Or You just get a minor fact wrong, but it's significant to the story. It's not going to change the world or end the day, but the little things. I'm not, I guess, a perfectionist, but I don't like getting things wrong. So the little things are that are the stuff that drive me nuts that I actually lose sleep over. Major mistake. Thankfully, nothing is coming right to mind.
Never burned a bridge.
No, because I get back to where I'm. If it's, do I burn the bridge? Or do I break the story and hey, I'm heralded right now at this moment, and then tomorrow everybody forgets about it except the bridge I burned. I go with not burning the bridge because nothing's that important that a relationship or a trust is worth breaking, in my opinion.
Now, you know, because I've been in radio for many years, and that's a funny business, too. Either people can be very friendly with other competitors, radio competitors, or they're not. How is it with you where you have to be first on the scene for a lot of these stories? Is it very competitive out there against other local TV networks and reporters?
Probably deep down it is, but I'll tell you, on the surface, people here in this town, and some of you might find this hard to believe, are really friendly and nice.
Really?
And good people to each other. Yeah, because we've all been there. You've all been the person who you get there and all of a sudden, oh, I don't have a piece of equipment that I need. Hey, don't worry about it. You're here. We're here. We'll share it with you. You know, I mean, it doesn't happen often, but there's a great, I think, camaraderie among the different, and you might, there might be an individual at this station or that station who, you know, is a hard ass or, you know, has a stick up their
keister. Anyone you want to name?
No, they're mostly, they're all great, and especially on the morning show. I'm on the morning show and just really
other morning
good
shows
people.
Are good?
Yeah, all, especially the people I run into out in the field, especially everybody who's out in the field, are just great people. And yeah, you're not going to give up if you have a great piece of information or you just got a great interview. You're not going to say, hey, you know, you might want to go call so-and-so on this story because they're really talking and giving you a great account of what's happening here or what happened. You're not going to necessarily give something up. But if you're all there together and I just find it very cordial, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, well, you seem
and maybe
to
surprisingly so.
Yeah, surprising.
For people to hear
that.
Yeah. And maybe it's the aura you put out. I mean, I think I'm a friendly guy and I like
you
people.
Are.
So I don't think people are going to, you know, see me coming and be like, oh, here's a-hole Barnard. Let's, you know, let's turn our backs and squirrel away our great exclusive interview. Not that they're going to give anything up, but, you know, I just think how you treat people is how they treat you. And I am treated very well by my colleagues at other stations in town and at the radio stations and at the newspapers, too.
So you have been here in D.C. for some major events, including 9/11, mm-hmm. D.C. snipers.
Oh, yeah.
And you're actually in the museum, I hear, for something that happened during 9/11?
There's a photograph, yeah. I was at the Pentagon that first day. I actually started out trying to get to the White House because before the Pentagon was struck, we figured, hey, if they've hit two towers, what's to stop them from hitting something here? And my instinct was they're going to go for the White House next. I mean, I'm assuming Flight 93 was heading to the Capitol or the White House, but probably the Capitol. But we were trying to get as close to the White House as we could, and they kept pushing us back. So I was reporting from like Farragut Square and the metro station there that morning before the towers came down and the metro was running and there was chaos on the streets. But I ended up not long after that heading over to the Pentagon and was there till 2 a.m. And a still photographer named Molly Bingham, who later got kidnapped in Iraq and became kind of a story herself in the Iraq War. She was their freelance photographer and came to the gas station just west of the Pentagon where all the media had set up that day when, you know, the first responders were still at it. And there were flare-ups in the building that first afternoon and night. So we were all in one spot, basically. But I had positioned ourselves at a certain corner of the gas station where you could actually see into the crater that was created by Flight 77. Where everybody else was, there was a street sign, like a street sign that blocked the way. And so you were kind of seeing the Pentagon, but you couldn't see where the plane hit. So I found a part of the gas station where you could, but only from on top of the truck, our live truck.
Wow.
Because there was a big hill behind the gas station.
Okay.
But I found a ladder in the dumpster where you climbed the ladder to change the gas prices at the gas station.
Okay.
So it was just kind of stored in the dumpster. And so I pulled the ladder out. It was a big 8-foot ladder, climbed to the top of that, and I could see. So I sat on top of the ladder. The photographer sat on top of the truck. And for that whole afternoon and night, you could see right into the Pentagon, right where the plane had hit. And most everybody else, if you look back on the early stuff, there was a big street sign, big overhang, like a 395
they
sign.
They couldn't actually see the hole.
Right. And my instinct was, I want to see the hole.
And that is the picture that's in the museum.
Exactly. This still
with
photographer
it,
climbed our truck. Yeah, well, and she'd said, I need to get some shots. And it was the best vantage point at that on that first day, at that time, to see the Pentagon. So she climbed up. We let her climb up, and she said, don't rock the truck too much. Take some pictures. And then I heard about 6-8 months later or whatever from the museum saying, hey, we see a picture of you sitting on a ladder at the Pentagon. Can you tell me about it? And I had no idea what they were talking about. It turns out that photographer took a picture of me sitting on the ladder reporting that night, and that's the one image that she took that made anything. And the museum put it in a book, and then it's on display at their 9/11 exhibit at the museum. And it's just showing how people covered the terrorist attacks that day. And there's the picture of me sitting on the ladder at the gas station.
What did you think when 9/11 was happening? Were you like, okay, we're going to be in a massive world war after this. This just can't be real. I mean, what did you, like, that must have been one of those moments in your career. A huge highlight. I mean, that's like your history.
Yeah. A major low light for our country, obviously.
Yeah.
My initial thought, and I was actually on a treadmill at the gym when the first one hit and thought, oh my goodness. And people were saying, what an accident. I knew right away, honestly.
Really?
I'm not kidding. I knew right away because I leaned over to my wife and said, oh my God, she was on the next treadmill. And I'm like, that's not an accident. You don't just fly into the building like that by accident. At least I didn't think. And then the second one hit. And I said to her, the White House is next. Let's go. And we ran and I went right to work. And so my thought was not like, hey, we're going to be a world at war right now. Mine was like, what's next? What? Oh, my God, where are they coming to next? And that day was just crazy, complicated by the fact that I'm from the New York area.
And oh, my God,
I heard early on, actually, as I was the first assignment, they were going to send me to Union Station to get on a train to go to New York City. The bosses called and said, get to New York. And we'll have a photographer meet you at Union Station. You guys are going to train it up.
Wow.
I was literally in a cab. I had gotten home, showered, threw stuff in a bag, and jumped in a cab. I was living in Adams Morgan. I was in the cab heading to Union Station when my mother called from Long Island, New York, and said that a very good family friend was in the North Tower. I knew he worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, but had heard from his parents that he had called his wife to say, we're trapped. And he was killed that day. And so I heard right away that not only did I know somebody was in that, did I know of somebody who was in the building, but my mother also said, when I told her where I was going, she said, well, the trains, nothing's moving. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, Amtrak,
everything. Stopped.
So I called the station and they said, yeah, you can't get to New York by train. Do whatever. And I said, I'm going to the White House because I honestly think that's so.
That was nice.
So the cab dropped me off as close to the White House as it could. And I met up with a photographer later. But from the very early going that day, I realized people I knew and loved and had known my whole life were dying or were dead. So it hit me kind of personally that, yeah, I'm doing this job, but a lot of people I know and care about are suffering. So it kind of got real.
Oh my God, I mean, there's another moment in your career. You must take a step back and go, I don't know. I mean, for you, I wonder how you stay positive. Because whenever I see you, Bob, you always are smiling. You're so positive. But you have covered a lot of shitty things
over
your career. And it's amazing to me that you're not super depressed.
No. And you know what? I'm blessed. Because I know people who do suffer from depression.
Yes.
I never have. I sleep like a baby most every night. I'm very lucky. I am very lucky.
Yeah.
But I don't want to sound heartless. I mean, these things do impact you. And talking about, like, you know, knowing information, I knew, like, that day that they were collecting, they asked my friend's wife for his toothbrush so that they could compare the DNA from his toothbrush to possible remains that would be found. And that stuff I knew, but I, you know, do I go report that? So I kind of held certain. So
things
again,
back,
there are certain things you know and you hear and you're like, yeah, that's interesting, but I'm not going to share that. In terms of the impact these things have on me, yeah, I am human, but I also love life and I know I am blessed. And I've just felt that way my entire life. And so I try to keep that aura and share it that even, you know, in the darkest day, that's what they tell school kids, you know, yeah, there were bad people that day who killed a lot of people, but there were a lot of heroes too.
Yeah.
Who rushed to the aid of the people who are suffering. And so I'm kind of a glasses half full kind of guy. So I try to, you know, life, you know, we're here Ultimately, such a brief time.
Yes, it's
and
crazy.
I don't want to be the downer guy, even though a lot of what we report on and cover is sad and kind of a downer. I look at life as, you know, a blessing every day, honestly.
So you touched upon it earlier. One of the best decisions of your life was marrying your wife. Mm-hmm. And how many kids do you two have?
We have two.
So how did you meet your wife?
She's a newspaper reporter. So
really?
we met on a story down in Florida. She was a newspaper in Florida, and I was as well in Tampa. And we met at a helicopter crash. Again, a Tampa police officer died, sadly, riding in the second seat of a helicopter. And the next day, I was on day two of covering it. She was the newspaper reporter covering it. A mutual friend introduced us, and we ended up meeting up at a bar, kind of like a media night, different people from different stations in the newspaper and the radio stations, kind of meeting casually on a Friday night. And, oh, yeah, I remember meeting you on the side of the river. Yeah, how's it going? Whatever. And we talked, and I knew right away, oh, my goodness.
Really?
Oh, God, yeah.
And you knew you totally. So how long after you guys met did you get married?
6 years.
See, everybody tells me that about relationships, that they knew the one.
Yeah.
Did your wife know that about you, or were you kind of the one that knew it, and then eventually she got on board?
You'd have to ask her. You know what? She has told me that what struck her, and it's not happening right now today, but that I was a good listener and that I like seemed to care about her. You know, a lot of guys will just talk about themselves like I'm doing now, sadly. But you know what I mean? That first night we met, she was like, oh my God, you actually asked me a question about myself and a follow-up question. You were interested in my family. And I wasn't interviewing her like a reporter
right,
would interview.
It was just like
but
this
we were having a
conversation.
And so right away she says, I knew that you were a little different because you actually listened and seemed curious about my life and weren't just blabbing on about yours. And I just knew, just being a guy who's met a lot of people over the years and pretty good, I think, a judge of people's character. That she was a cut above.
Oh my God, how long have you two been married?
14 years.
Is marriage easy?
I'll tell you what, to me, it's easy when you're married to the right one.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's the day-to-day. I mean, there are things that piss you off about each other.
Right.
Like, in a minor way, maybe. I probably piss her off a lot more than she pisses. I know for a fact that I piss her off more than she pisses me off. But it's easy when I, at least from where I'm sitting, looking at her, when that's a great person, a great character person on the other side, it's easy because you're married to someone who's just a really quality human being who is a positive thinker and just has great judgment and shows great affection. And if you respect that person, you know.
So I'm assuming you both had probably dated a lot of people prior to meeting each other.
Sure.
Did you ever like feel anything close to what you felt for your wife with these other relationships? Because to me, I'm always fascinated by relationships, right? Right now in D.C., such a single city, so many people are looking for relationships. So many people I've interviewed here in the Fox 5 newsroom are looking for relationships. And then there's people like you who are really happily married. And you're like, how does one person do it and the other is still searching? So what?
Luck.
You think it's luck?
I really do.
Do you think it's luck, really? Or do you think that people just, you know, don't really hold out for the person that is perfect for them?
And there's no perfect, there is no perfect, right. So there is no perfect person.
Perfect for them, not perfect in the...
But I think luck, because you see people and you're like, wow, look at those two. That's like, you think that guy found someone and she found someone. There's somebody for everybody, I think. But yeah, if you're looking for perfection, you'll never find it because there's always probably going to be something about everybody that you maybe could do without or would think could be improved upon. But if you're realistic and... Yeah, it's a tough one because I think you need to be in love with someone. You need to feel it. You can't just be like, wow, I don't feel anything, but boy, she's great and she's got this. All right, let's give it a shot. I mean, I think you got to be like, I still kid her. I get the warm fuzzies. If I haven't seen her for a couple
after
of days or whatever,
years.
If she's been away, oh yeah, if she's been away for a weekend or whatever and there she comes, oh my God, I feel like Ronald Reagan talking about Nancy. But it's true. I do. I'm like, oh, there she is. And so
that's
you can't
awesome.
Fake that. You can't concoct that. So you got to be lucky enough to have that. But you can't, yeah, you do. As long as most of the right things are there, the things that you care about based on trial and error from your past experience of dating, if most of it's there, then yeah, don't be waiting for something that may not be out there, that you may never find, because then you'll be, I mean, I've known people who just have never found the right one or rushed it. You know, sometimes
yeah, right?
You said, what the hell? It's good as it gets.
Yeah.
Well, usually doesn't, no.
So now you have two kids. Mm-hmm. Have your children changed your perspective on your work or on life? How has that affected you?
Well, it's put things in perspective because to me now, actually, family's the most important thing. So with scheduling or where I want to go, to me, I don't care where I work as long as I'm with my family. You know, if my wife today said, hey, for whatever reason, we need to move out to Denver or we got to move to Cleveland for family. Hey, let's go. I'll get a job somewhere. I think, you know, optimistically. I would. I'd be like, screw it. We got to go. Sorry, boss. But I'm going where she is.
Oh, my God.
Because I've got family, kids. So my perspective has changed in terms of what's important. I still love my job. I care about every little, like I said, I'm not a perfectionist, but I care about even the littlest details. And if it goes wrong, it pisses me off. I love coming to work. I love my job. But the kids put a perspective on it. Like when they asked me to go to the morning shift, I had been on nights for 10 years. Then I was on a day shift for a year. And then they said, hey, can you do mornings? And I thought, sure. And then when I checked with my wife, it's like, you know, this would actually work better for our family because I'll be home after school. I can help get them to their practices or their sporting events or their whatever. So this morning shift, which I love yeah. being a part of the morning team, really works well for my family. And so to me, that's the most important thing. It actually works well for my family. And you know, heck,
oh my God, Bob Barger, you seem like the perfect guy.
Oh, stop.
This
absolutely
could be like
not.
Your,
hello. Absolutely. Hello, world. That
I
is
think a
far
lot
from
of
the truth.
Female listeners are going to go, okay, where's my Bob Barger?
No. Don't do that, people. You will be sadly mistaken. I found the one who will overlook all the crap. And,
okay, I want to ask you kind of a lightning round of 5 questions.
Right.
Okay, so you just have to answer these. They can be one word. They can be explanations.
But I've been pretty lame. What's your biggest mistake? What's the breaking story? I've come up with duds for you.
No, you've been so fascinating.
Well,
I mean, I...
So I'll try the lightning round, but you're going to hear a lot of buzzers, I'm afraid.
I hear that you have a potty mouth. So what's your favorite swear word?
Oh, it's a mix of words, but
you have
can
to
I say it?
Yes, of course. This is like, this completely has been cleared by management. They
Are you
want,
serious?
Yeah, I'm dead serious.
Okay. Because I've never cursed on air. I've come close, but I never have.
Everybody has
the
said
bosses
they want
say
it
it's
unfiltered.
Okay.
Yes.
Tom Fitzgerald, my colleague, often says it involves a woman's body part, bodily fluid, like shit, cut motherfucking shit, you know, like that, you know.
It's not just one.
It's usually, sorry, folks, it's usually a combination of several things, and I don't plan it. It just comes out.
I love it.
Oh, thank you.
You've never been caught swearing on?
No, I've never sneezed on TV 30 some odd years later. I've been very lucky. Yeah, I've come close because you think your mic is off and it turns out it's not off and it was not off and you almost said something.
Oh my God.
So I've been very lucky because I'll let them fly, but not usually when the mic's open. I just did.
I asked you this at the beginning. I'm fascinated by some stories in D.C. over the years. Who do you think actually killed Chandra Levy? After all these years, we're talking about a retrial. People are still fascinated by this. You have the inside scoop. Who killed her?
I doubt it's this...
Igmar Gwandike?
Gwandike, yeah. I mean, it could be. But just because of who she was and who she was with, it just seemed like it was more than just a happenstance murder to me. Now, maybe it was this guy who subsequently attacked other people and got caught with that, and then they pinned it on him.
What has always the rumor been? That people thought Gary Condit had more to do with it than
that the congressman
ever...
may have some knowledge of something, but they've never been able to prove it. I would think if they could prove it, or if it was him, it would have happened. He would have been arrested and charged and what have you. That hasn't happened. So I don't know. I mean, that's who you'd like to think, oh, my God, it was the sensational person. But it must not be. And so I don't believe it is, but I don't necessarily feel convinced that it's this Gwandike guy either.
It's so fascinating.
Has someone gotten away with that murder? Quite possibly.
That's a story that just keeps on, yeah. There's so much fascination around that.
Absolutely.
Who's your favorite local reporter to watch when you're not?
I love Pat Collins.
You're a Pat Collins fan.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he's such a great guy. He is such a great guy. And I just, maybe some people don't find it old fashioned, whatever. I just, when he's on, I can't turn the channel. I just love watching Pat Collins tell a story.
You're sucked in.
Oh, absolutely.
One other murder question I'm fascinated by. D.C. Mansion murders. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Darren Wendt, the guy who's arrested now, worked alone?
Absolutely not.
Really?
Absolutely not.
So you think there's more to that story?
Yeah, yes, definitely.
Okay, what can you tell us?
Well, all I know is when he was arrested, he was in a truck with a bunch of cash and his brother, but the brother's never been arrested, so perhaps they've already exhausted their interviewing process and their evidence gathering, and they realize he wasn't part of it. He was just, you know, kind of cashing in with what his brother had allegedly done. But I just can't believe one guy alone. I guess
held
it could happen. It could happen. Yes. But to wreak that much havoc, to cause that much pain, to kill one guy who's eating pizza and acting like, you know, an idiot and a murderous, evil person. So he's the only one charged, and it's been more than a year, but I can't believe he acted alone, this Darren Wendt. And allegedly, nothing's been proven, but
right.
I can't believe that he would be the only person charged in this crime.
There's another story, so bizarre.
Absolutely.
I mean, how the hell?
And that house is still standing there. If you drive by, it's still got a chain link fence around it. Yep, the windows are boarded up still. It's just, imagine, and that's a very, you know, exclusive neighborhood. And imagine everybody's walking their dogs every day or going for walks or runs in the neighborhood or driving home at the end of a night, having to pass that house and know the horror that was committed in there. It's awful.
Is there a motto or piece of advice that you live by?
Yeah. Treat people the way you'd like people to treat you or someone you care about.
And that's that's really worked for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And even in the heat of the moment on the job where you might say, fuck shit, you know.
Yeah.
Motherfucking shit balls, you know, directed at somebody but just kind of laid out there, I feel bad right away. I'm like, sorry, dude, you know, let me buy you a beer or whatever. That's my thing. It's just, even if it's in the heat of the moment, things get kind of rough, but step it back and treat people the way that, to me, and even in the field. Like, that's why I don't like to burn a bridge. Like, if someone tells me something like, hey, you can't report this, but here's what's going on. Okay, I'm going to put that in the back of my... I'm not going to throw it out on Twitter, because would I want someone to do that to me?
Yeah, exactly.
If I said to someone, hey, personally, here's the deal. You know, so-and-so, this is happening, and, it sucks, but this is what's going on. And the next you're reading about it, it's like, dude, did I just not say, hey, you know, this was between you and me?
But do you think you have to be an asshole to get ahead? I mean, you've interviewed CEOs, you've worked for bosses. Mm-hmm. Do you really think, because it seems like in the workplace a lot of times, the people who are the biggest dicks get ahead. So you don't believe that's true?
I think that happens, and in my single years, you'd be at a bar and you'd be like, that hot lady is talking to that total douchebag who's like talking to his buddies and ignoring her, and I'm sitting here by myself with my friends not talking to anyone. What? How could that gorgeous woman be putting up with that crap? And that happens. But I learned in my job early on, I was working one shift and another reporter is working a different shift. So she covered the story during the day and I covered the story at night. And when it was all said and done, one of the key people involved came up to me and said, you know what? You got everything and more than what she got. And she was a hard ass, pain in the ass, thought this hurt way was the right way to get the information. But you being the nice guy and just calling and being cool about it, you learned everything that was to be learned and then some compared to that. And that was early on. And I realized you don't have to be a dick and treat people like an ass to get what you want.
Oh my God, Bob Barnard, you've been an amazing interview. I feel like that is the headline of this podcast.
Nice guys
can get ahead. Yeah. And then cock, fuck, shit, you know.
Motherfucking shitballs.
Bob, where can people follow you on social media?
Well, they're not going to follow me anymore if they think that stream of profanity is going to come with it.
No, you're so polite in real life and on social media. But
I
just love hearing things about you in the newsroom. And that big one was like, oh my God, Bob Barnard has such a potty mouth. I'm like, really? I got to hear this. Okay.
Oh, my God. Sorry. I'm sorry you just did. So I'm on Twitter at BarnardFox5DC and then on Facebook. I get the social media thing. I don't know. I'm right there with it, but I just assume people see me on the street and say, hey, how you doing, man? But you're
no,
not going to often
not
run
anymore.
Into people. So, yeah, they're just... So is that what you're asking? Like,
yes.
How they can find you? Just
perfect.
On that kind of thing, social media. And I don't post a lot. Just I don't want to waste people's time. So what I put out there is the stuff that I would find interesting.
Yeah,
so I
that's
try to share that.
About.
If I'm at a scene or covering a story and think it's worthy of promoting, then I'll throw it out there.
Awesome. Bob, thank you so much.
Oh,
thanks
thank
for being
you,
on the podcast.
Sarah. Thank you.